Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. Be sure to join us this year in Indianapolis at FDIC International 2020. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
All right, hello, good evening, or morning, or day, whatever time that you listen to this program. I'm Jason Hovelman with Engine House Training. I'm also fire chief in Florissant, Missouri. Welcome to another FDIC. We're just 2 months away, really. It's coming around the corner. And if you haven't registered your classes, I do know that the hot classes are filling up pretty quick. They've got some new classes that you need to look at the show guide and figure out what you're going to do. And if you're new to FDIC and you haven't attended in the past, you're really doing yourself a disservice if you don't take some hands-on training while you're there. The classroom sessions and workshops are fantastic by some of the best, brightest minds in the fire service, but the hands-on training is really where it's at your first handful of years going to FDIC to really hone those skills, make some really good contacts. You can ask the instructors some really good questions and spend some time with them on one-on-one with skills and techniques, things of that nature. So I really encourage you to do that if you get the opportunity. And don't forget to check out Monday, Tuesday are hot classes and workshops. They're all 4 and 8 hour sessions. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday are opening sessions. Wednesday morning, Thursday morning, and then about 10 o'clock, the classroom sessions start. They're an hour 45, and it's always, you can kind of bounce around. You've got a smorgasbord, so to speak, of class options and topics that you can take. And then, of course, Thursday afternoon, the exposition show starts. If you're into fire trucks, equipment, flashing and blinking lights, that's the place for you. And you can spend literally days walking through there, talking to vendors and kind of determining if you've got needs in your department and really honing down on some of that information. Tonight, I'm really happy to have a guest that is local to St. Louis. He's highly motivated, incredibly intelligent, and has done a lot. And I first got to know him through the St. Louis City Fire Department, where he served on some busy engine and ladder truck companies, served on the command staff, special operations. I'm going to let him really give a lot of his background. But tonight, he and I are going to talk about formal education and its role in the fire service. And it's not exclusive to experience, so it's not one or the other. And he's going to do a phenomenal job explaining that and talking about some issues that are coming at us in the fire service that are going to require us to put a different thinking cap on at times and probably get out of our comfort zones where we all like to reside. And so tonight I'm very happy to have Greg Faver on the show with us tonight.
Hey Chief, it's great to be here. I appreciate the invite to come in and talk a bit.
Yeah, when I saw this topic and it's timely, if you watch social media, and I know you've got a great Twitter feed and a great following on there, and you put really, I know Twitter, right? Luckily, we don't have to censor this. But
sure.
You've got a great Twitter feed, and you put really relevant stuff on there. But I also know your background. And so when things started happening in Atlanta, and everybody started having an opinion about that, and we can go back to Polk County, and you and I could probably sit here and just talk about all the different instances where this debate about quote-unquote paper chiefs versus salty experienced chiefs come into play. And you and I had a brief discussion on the phone earlier in the week about what that means and how we get it wrong sometimes in the fire service, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There's a dichotomy in certain sections of the fire service that you can only be one or the other. That you can, you know, you can only be a hard charge and smoke eater, or you're a nerd chief. You're sitting behind a desk, you're pushing glasses up, and you're figuring out, you know, how to do budgets. That dichotomy is often pushed internally by us, right? We're not getting that from cops. We're not getting that from city managers. That's something that's kind of self-driven in our profession. And I think, and obviously, you know, this is everything I say tonight is my opinion, not my agency, not who I represent. But I think that's going to end up hurting us pretty severely in the long term as we see some pretty significant changes coming across the landscape of the American Fire Service.
Yeah, I agree. And just for the listeners, kind of give people, you know, where you came from, what you've accomplished, and to give a background on, you know, what you're about, because you're an intelligent guy. You've got a lot of education behind you, but you worked in some salty companies in St. Louis City.
I you know, everybody wants to be the bad dude on the block, but yeah, I'm very proud of my firefighting time. I'll give just two tracks, and I'll give the one that everybody cares about first. I'm fourth generation public servant, so you know I come from a background, not all in the fire service, some of it in law enforcement, but you know, fourth generation public servant, grew up kind of in the mix. Seeing this, knew I wanted to do it. Literally right out of high school, I told my parents I was going to take the test to get on the city fire department. You know, shout out to the St. Louis City Fire Department, justifiably proud, second oldest career fire department in the country. Number one in your hearts, I'm sure. Unfortunately, St. Louis City didn't hire until you were 21. And I found a small department out by Kansas City. It was a full-time union job. I took the test, and I started on that fire department about 6 weeks after graduating high school here in St. Louis. I was 18. I was a union fireman. I was working full time. I was going to a state university, working on an emergency management bachelor's. Hung out there until I was just over 21. Took the test for the city. Scored well. Came and worked. Came, you know, pretty soon after 21. Came to St. Louis. Out of the academy, I was assigned to Engine Company 24. Which is up on the city's turbulent north side. When I was up there, the years that I was up there, it was one of the busiest companies in the city, certainly top five. They run about 3,800 runs a year. About 800 of those are working fires. It was a great company, really small house, both, you know, single engine company and just a really small house. And we had a lot of tradition. We had a lot of pride. We would sit around every night and play cards. And, you know, our captain had a rule, you know, no TV after dinner. You'd sit and talk and tell stories and jokes and make fun of each other. It was a great 5 years for a young guy coming on the job in a big city and really learning from some experienced, dedicated firemen. From there, I went to a Midtown truck company that serves, you know, St. Louis University, some of the central corridor areas of the city. Really good experience, first time really being on a truck company. We were second in for like seven companies, and that was a really good opportunity to see a different side of the job. Spent a couple years there. It was a little bit slower, but it was good because I was actually back in school at the time. From there, I went to Rescue Squad 2, which is one of two special operations companies in the city. Rescue 2 is the busier one. It covers Midtown and North City, where most of the fires come in at. And the first opportunity I had to take the test, there were about 460 guys taking my captain's test. I scored number 9. I was made on the first day because we had enough openings that I was promoted the first day that the list was certified. From there, I went down. I joined the fire chief's command staff. I was over special operations, homeland security, and special events. So anything big in the city, rolling out new policies about how our Marine unit worked, overseeing the tactical EMS teams. You know, I spent three weeks in Ferguson, Missouri, while all of the rioting and stuff was going on. I was. You know, on the tactical medic team, and I was up there with my guys working with them. great experience. It also showed me kind of where some of our knowledge gaps are that we'll talk about, you know, just today in the show, in the fire service, because my job had me interfacing with a lot of elected officials. It had me interfacing down at City Hall with you know, some people who were responsible for our budgeting and things like that. And I could see kind of where the fire department wasn't filling in all of the gaps that we probably should have been. And my last, from there, I was actually tapped by the governor to leave St. Louis City, and I served as the state's deputy secretary and chief of operations for the Missouri Department of Public Safety. I really didn't want to leave St. Louis City. I was really proud. I am terrifically proud to have been a city fireman. I love the fire chief. I'd do anything for him. It was an opportunity to serve as the first fire service member in one of the two top positions. At no point in the history of the state of Missouri has a firefighter had either the secretary or deputy secretary role. And I thought it was my chance to get in there and do some real good for emergency management, for the fire marshal's office, for the fire service at large. And we were able to knock out a whole bunch of stuff in the 2 years that I was in the state capitol. But it was a great experience. I was the number two in a 15,000 person organization. We had a multi-billion dollar asset profile, several hundred million dollars of annual operating budget. We had all of the legislative stuff that comes with being in the state capitol, fighting for your resources. I was the incident commander for some federal flooding, for tornadoes, for some law enforcement operations, for a major search and rescue event that we had. It was literally jumping off into the deep end and doing some incredible things that most people don't get to do in their career. And I was terrifically happy and fortunate and humbled to get to do that work under two different governors. And then I currently serve as the chief executive officer and the executive director of the St. Louis Regional Response System, which is a collection of multidisciplined emergency managers who kind of oversee the UAC funding. They work on the THIRA, the threat analysis for the region, and allocate not only funding but training and strategy around some of the most complex issues for the St. Louis region. So that's kind of in my operational arc. Academically, throughout all of this stuff, I continued to go to school. I continued to go to classes. I want to, in the same way that I want to be a better operator, in the same way that I want to, you know, be a better ropes and knots guy, I want to understand the problems that I'm facing administratively. So I just kept going to school. So I earned a bachelor. I actually double majored. I went to grad school the first time, and I got a master's in public health, which a lot of my research there kind of worked around how the fire service interfaces with other agencies like EMS, like law enforcement, like public works, public health. From there, a few years later, I went to the Naval Postgraduate School. I'm sure some people have heard about the program at NPS. That was a scholarship through DHS, and I earned a second master's in national security studies there. And then from there, I actually spent a year as a fellow at Harvard University at the School of Government, where, again, I worked on communication problems relative to public safety in general. How do we connect with our public? How do we talk to people about the issues that we know as professionals in this field are issues? It doesn't matter if we're talking to each other about this. We need to talk to the people that actually need the information. So I worked on some research there and got published out of Harvard. That was kind of the last big thing I did. And I have to caveat all of this with, this was tough. Like, this required work. Nobody in my family before me had gone to college. My father was a police officer and a Teamster. My mom worked in sales. We were not wealthy people. At times, my wife and I have taken out student loans to be able to do this. It meant coming home. It meant working at the firehouse. It meant coming home and not spending time with friends because I had a test coming up. So I don't want anybody to think that this is somehow like a unique situation. Like, you know, I chose to put my head down and grind against this because it's important to the profession. And I wanted to have a seat at the table. This was not like, you know, I don't come from a family of college professors, and I had to carve away. And if I can do it sitting at engine 24 on the second floor while everybody else is napping, then it's very possible for everybody else to do as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great background because, you know, and in some respects, you know, this whole debate that we're going to get into a little bit, and we're not going to cover it all tonight, but it struck me, and it's exactly what you just talked about, having a seat at the table. And you also mentioned something that's unique to Missouri, and you and I have a very good understanding of this, but most of the public safety positions in the state of Missouri historically have gone to law enforcement. The fire official,
yes,
the director
overwhelmingly,
of public safety,
yes.
It's always gone to law enforcement. And you're right. Having you go to that position was a milestone in the state of Missouri for the fire service to actually have somebody at that level with the qualifications, the education, the operational background coming from a busy urban fire department, being able to influence policy in a lot of ways, and the deployment packages, models that we see from the state level and regional level, it makes a big, big difference. And I think that's something that people lose sight of when you talk about formal education, and people argue, well, you know, I've never seen a master's degree put out a fire. And you're right. You're right. But if you look at most fire departments, mine included, Greg, actually putting out fires is about 5% of what we do every year as an organization, and the rest of it's personnel and the things, policies. Kind of want you to speak on a little bit is that seat at the table and how important, you know, that's been or should be. And one example that comes to my mind, Greg, is Adam Thiel in Philadelphia, what he's been able to accomplish there, you know, and the initial thoughts of some people when he went there and what he's done are two very different things. And it's a lot of it is because of his education and his understanding of policy and the system, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Adam has been a great role model for me. And I think a lot of people can learn from both his trajectory and his approach. I mean, he is the chief now of a tough, busy fire department that has never hired an outside chief. You know, he had been a chief somewhere else, but it was a much smaller department, much different size budget. He had worked for the governor in a cabinet role, very educated. I think at one point he applied to be a White House fellow, which is, you know, a very prestigious thing to even compete for. And he walked into, you know, one of the tougher, busier, saltier fire departments in the country. And, you know, when I talk to people on the side who work there, friends that I've known from my travels and my training, they say, like, look, the guy's killing it. Like, you know, it nobody is always going to be happy 100% of the time with leadership. That's part of the burden of leadership, is that you have to own the responsibility. You have to own the decision-making. But Adam does a really good job of making some believers out of what most likely started out as disbelievers. But the true measure on the administrative side of the house, right? I've never seen a master's degree put out a fire. Yes, that's 100% right. There's no getting around the work, right? You have to get through the work. If the work is you have to drag a pre-connect down a long hallway and make the turn into the fire apartment, like, there's no getting around that. That's part of the work, and you have to embrace that side of the job, and you have to do it really well. That's not the only side of the job, right? And in the same way that there's no getting around that work, there's no getting around, you know, arguing with your city manager, your mayor, your budget office, your city council around staffing. Right, around code enforcement, around what kind of trucks you want to buy for the good of the agency. If you can't take a seat at the table, if you can't exert your share of influence in the discussion. And it sucks. I don't make the rules, but there are plenty of city managers out there who have MBAs or MPAs, and, you know, they look down on firemen. That, you know, I'm not saying across the board. I'm saying that it happens. Look, go sit in your garage. We'll call you if we need you. Part of having that piece of paper, whether it's your EFO, whether it's your CFO, whether it's going to grad school, whether it's getting a bachelor's, part of that is buying in. It's like an ante to sit at the table, right? I don't gamble, but I know that if you want to play with big stakes, you have to put some money down to show that you belong at that table. And that's largely what we're talking about. The piece of paper doesn't do the work for you. It gives you a set of tools to sit at the table. And if we care about the fire service, right? And I would imagine anybody who's taken time to listen to a fire engineering podcast cares about the profession. If we care about the profession, then we will do what is necessary to take care of our brother and sister firefighters. And part of that is making sure that we volunteer to teach the classes that we know. Part of it is instituting a certain culture in your firehouse that we wake up and we clean the trucks, or, you know, the probie is the last one to bed, or, you know, hey, you carry the medical bag because your time, you know, whatever those little bitty rules are, we build upon those, right? And good officers take care of their companies in very specific ways. Good chiefs, part of being a good chief, part of being a good administrator is making sure that you can sit at the table where you can make major influence. You can make major strides or give up major ground for the men and women who are working in that firehouse today, right? And it's everything from what type of rescue gear are we going to buy to what type of pumpers are we going to buy to how many people are going to ride on them to what our code enforcement models look like to what your folks are going to get paid to what your budget looks like to send people to outside training. All of these decisions are going to be made. No city is gonna not buy fire trucks. So why wouldn't we put somebody at the table who has cleaned the same bathrooms, who's gotten into the sink in our kitchen at the firehouse? Why wouldn't we do our best to position our people who have done the things that we have done as firefighters in that room to be able to influence that discussion? And that's what EFO, that's what CFO, that's what a master's degree does, is it helps you buy in to the room so that you can get in there and better take care of the responders that you are charged with.
Yeah, I agree. I look at it in a couple different ways. The same reason that we promote company officers to the positions that they're in, hopefully the reason we're doing it, is because they can handle personnel. They have a way to relate to the members of their company. They know they're very intimate with the job. They understand why we pull this line and why we take it on this particular building. They know why we're going to come off the back on this fire. They know their response area, and they also are able to answer the question why when they get a new member coming in. They can explain in great detail why we push through the front door on these buildings, or if we have fire below us, we may throw some water in the window, or whatever those things are. They're intimate about the job. The same thing has to be said, and you're exactly right, because I've been in the position. I've been a chief for a year, excuse me, and I've been in conversations with decision makers and that are expecting feedback from me on topics that I didn't have enough knowledge in. You know, you talk, it's easy to say, well, sure, we don't know about budgets. Budgets are very complex things depending on the size of your organization and depending on how you're using it. You sit down with bond counsel and they start asking about your debt service. You don't even know what that means.
Yes.
You know, when you start looking at insurance formulas and your work comp formulas and all these different things, which have a direct impact on the members who are putting out fires. And I just look at it, and it's one of those things that just because I need to know all this stuff, it doesn't diminish the fact that I've crawled down several hallways. I've made a few rescues. Mm-hmm. I've been in a number of fires. It doesn't change that experience. And every department's different, right? You know, we got small departments in Missouri and all over the country that the chief has to go to every call. And then you've got departments like mine at Forest, where I don't hardly ever go to any calls because we've got battalion chiefs running everything. In the St. Louis City probably is, you know, similar. And so you need to know that role. But I guess, you know, the question for where I'm always curious is, at what point did the fire service decide that degrees are BS, I'm not going to get one, we need chiefs with just experience?
What's that, say again?
And what's the real ramification of that?
It can't be positive, right? I mean, so we know, and again, I would venture to guess that most people who are hitting play on this podcast probably know this, even if they don't admit to it. The job is getting more dangerous and more complex every single day. Even if, you know, I was fortunate to be on a department that is in a very old city. There's a good percentage of it that is lower socioeconomic. St. Louis goes to a lot of fires every day, right? I mean, they turn the tap often. I realize that that is not the case for many departments around the country. Notwithstanding, fires today, when you do get them, are incredibly dangerous. And we're not going to turn this into a building construction class. We're not going to turn this into like a code enforcement, you know, sprinklers. And like, it's just getting more dangerous. We know this. Buildings are falling down. They're killing firefighters more often. The room and contents, things that are actually on fire are more dangerous. They burn hotter. All the things that the listeners probably already know, coupled with all of the things that we're being shouldered with across that's non-firefighting, right? Whether it's tech rescue, whether it's hazmat, whether it's active shooter, tactical EMS, rescue task force things, EMS, pre-hospital care, generally, I mean, we just continue. The fire service has raised its hand more than often and said, we can do this. And it's one reason why we enjoy very broad support in most areas of the country, because we are the ultimate problem solvers. We see issues and we figure out a way, either on that call or generally as a profession, how can we influence this? How can we make it better? With that has come a significant amount of risk and a significant amount of complexity. I want, if I'm riding the front seat, if I'm the company officer, I want some great, hard-charging, experienced firefighters. I don't want the firefighter who's been to a million fires and only done the same thing, right? I don't need one bull who goes, I pull the engine 3/4 and I go towards fire, right? That's actually not helpful because not every fire requires that. I want a good leadoff person who looks at it and goes, all right, this type of building, I think we have this volume of fire, we're going to lead off with a big line. Or this is the fire location, this is where we're going to go. We should probably start fire attack somewhere about X in the building. I want those thinking firefighters. The same way that when we go to an active shooter situation and we're working with law enforcement around a rescue task force, same thing if we're going to a mass casualty event. I want responders, regardless of their rank, regardless of how much time they have on the job, regardless of how experienced they say they are or they actually are, whatever. I want thinking firefighters. That's the whole point of experience, right? We want people who not only have 20 years on the job, but have 20 years on the job and have learned and grown and can tell the new person, hey, don't do that. I did that once and I got hurt really bad. Don't do that. Those are the type of firefighters we want across the board at every rank. It is an extension of that mindset. It's an extension of that problem solving that we have brought for hundreds of years to our communities, where we should be able to look at a city council budget, or we should be able to look at proposed code enforcement issues, or we could look at major capital purchases, like this is what your new firehouse is going to look like, and be able to say, actually, no, that's not good for the community. It's not good for our responders. Here's what I propose instead. We need people. We need chiefs who are able to make and understand those decisions and how they're going to impact. Yeah, I mean, how often do fire departments buy trucks, right? I mean, you could conceivably. I know when I came on the job in St. Louis in the mid 2000s, I was on a 1988 Pierce Arrow. Right. You know, these fire trucks have been in play for 25 years. Somebody could come on the job, do 20 years, retire and ride the same fire truck the entire time. That purchase matters. Right. A chief being able to say to, you know, whoever's buying the trucks at the city council or budget level, look, no, I want pre-connects down low because my firefighters are having shoulder injuries and I'm going to take care of them. Here's what it's like to lead off, and here's why it needs to be low, right? That decision, that ability to see what the problem is, to speak up and have the authority to be in that room and be able to raise that concern about pre-connect placement is going to impact the decision, is going to impact the department for the next 20 years, conceivably. That's a big weight, and that's just one thing. That's one piece of one capital purchase that the chief can raise their hand and say, this isn't good, here's why, and here's what I propose. So this kind of subtle talk, across, and in some places it isn't so subtle. I mean, I've faced pushback across my career when people found out I was going to grad school. You know, what are you going to use that for? Oh, look at the big brain. You know, I mean, there's the same thing that I think everybody has experienced. Who's chosen this route, it's not necessarily easy, but it's absolutely necessary because the decisions will be made whether firefighters are in the room or not, and we have an obligation to ourselves, to our community, to be able to weigh in on decisions that are going to impact us for the course of an entire career. I think not everybody can be a chief, not everybody should be a chief, not everybody wants to be a chief. The same way that not everybody wants to be a captain or a lieutenant. I've met some pretty incredible drivers on the St. Louis Fire Department, and they want nothing more than to be the first primary driver, and they will, pardon my French, drive the shit out of that truck. I mean, they will make that thing sing. They'll have multiple lines off, and they'll be directing incoming traffic. I mean, there are some phenomenal drivers. But they have worked to get that way. They have spent the time, effort, and energy to say, this is important, and I'm going to be exceptional at this. That doesn't necessarily mean they went out and got a degree in hydraulics. It means they did spend the time investing and learning in what they needed to do to be exceptional drivers. Same thing with rescuemen, right? I know plenty of great rescue techs. You work with many of them at Engine House Training that – you know, the educational opportunities that they seek aren't necessarily in degree form, but they're going to FDIC. They're going to, you know, other classes. They're learning different things. It's the exact same thing, right? It's seeking educational opportunities to have tools to solve the problems that you see before you. I'm not exactly sure why formal education, you know, the degree or certification granting type has taken on a negative connotation. But we all know exceptional firefighters who are doing this day in and day out in areas that matter to them. If you want to be a senior leader, if you want to be in administration, you want to be able to, you know, make decisions for the benefit of the community and your department, you also have to go and seek out continuing educational opportunities like, you know, to your point, what is a bond? How do I craft a budget? How do I set a strategic plan? These things matter, and what's also important is that the people that are running cities now, generally speaking, if your mayor doesn't have a graduate degree, somebody on your city council does, or your city manager or city administrator does. I'm not saying it makes them any better. I'm not saying it makes them any worse. I'm saying that it exists, and they are going to hold you as a department head to a standard that they think is the standard the city should be held. And if you walk in and you don't know how to calculate, you know, projected overtime for the next quarter, that's immediately going to take away some of your bargaining power. So not only is it necessary for the department, it's necessary to maintain your influence.
Yeah, and I think two things come to mind as you were talking there is we've all been in a class at our fire departments over at a conference that was taught by a non-fire service instructor, whether it's about back, you know, ergometrics, or whether it's about behavior health or whatever it is. And we all know that some of them, the good ones, like we have an attorney who specializes in discrimination and harassment. She comes in once a year and we get our, you know, talks about our classes and talks about case studies. And she's effective because she speaks our language. She can relate to the fire service. As a senior staff person, if you walk into a city council, a county council, or meet with a finance director or a city manager, if you can't speak their language or at least make things relatable to what their world is, you're not going to be effective in getting the things that you need as a chief officer or senior staff person, because they, regardless of education, if you can't go in there and know what you're talking about when calculating overtime for the next quarter, or talking about work comp increases and how we need to reduce injuries, and it relates back to apparatus design because we went cheap with the lowest bid instead of the custom, whatever those things are, you have to be able to speak their language. And part of that is having a background in part of their world, right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I will happily say that I am like, I've been a medic. I've worked on an ambulance for the first couple of years of my career. I still hold my license with the state out of like just a sheer desire never to take the class again. I'm not great on an ambulance, right? Like that is not where my bread and butter is. Like I haven't worked on one in a long time, almost 20 years. I mean, I know that is not my skill set. I also know, in the few times before I went to the command staff where I would have to jump on because of multiple patients or because of, they needed an extra hand for something really bad or something like that, I knew that when I came through those doors, right, I had to, as you pointed out, be able to communicate effectively with the docs in order to convey the seriousness of what I was bringing in. I tried not to overstep and look ridiculous, but I tried to give, you know, confidence to the patient's family, confidence to the patient that like this wasn't my first day, and I was going to do everything I could to, you know, not have this person die. If we're doing that on the track, if we're doing that operationally, tactically, we should be able to do that administratively as well. That doesn't mean, you know, the first time I wrestled with budgets, like it was tough and I didn't like it. And I had to force myself to go Google terms to figure out what it meant. And I went and I talked to payroll and I went and I talked to a budget specialist down at City Hall. Like, what does this mean? How does this, like, it's uncomfortable and it's kind of going to be that way for a while on subjects you don't know. The same way that when you're learning ropes and knots or you're learning how to go downrange in a level A suit, it's uncomfortable. That's why we do it. That's why we train. But to pretend that, you know, our chief should be a salty smoke eater chief that knows when to pull us out of the building and that's it, cuts a large percentage of what administrators should be doing relative to taking care of their department. It's not about just that one fire you're on. It's about how you're creating a culture in your department, in your community for safety and sustainability across many good decisions. And I actually talked with Chief David Pennington, who is another good follow on Twitter. If we're going to, if we're going to throw out Twitter handles and stuff like that. He's the fire chief of Springfield, Missouri.
Great guy.
And he and I, great guy. And a real, like a real brother in the fire service, you know, I mean, just a really good, dedicated chief who is taking care of his community. He has his CFO certification and, you know, we were actually chatting about it the other day, and he was talking about, you know, look, we try to identify gaps in everything we do in the fire service, right? We flip over the beds in the bunk hall, and we put the new guy or the new gal in the bunk hall with their mask blacked out to see how they do right-handed searches, right? Every firehouse I've been to has done that with new guys in the first, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks. We go out and we throw ladders. We go out and we stretch lines and we pre-plan, you know, do we have enough pre-connect to get to this corner in the apartment because it's offset from the street? We work all the time in the fire service to try to identify gaps in what we're able to do. And being, going through the CFO process is not about saying I'm a chief fire officer and getting a sticker. It's actually about self-identifying where your gaps may be, so that if you want to be a chief, or you are a chief and you're trying to be a better chief, which hopefully all chiefs are trying to be better chiefs, you can actually go through the CFO process to not only see what you've done, which can be motivating, like, okay, like I can do this. It also helps you identify, look, I need to spend more time on budgeting. I need to spend better time understanding capital improvements and major capital purchases relative to my city or my jurisdiction's rules. And that's a really valuable thing to know where you need to work. And we do this in every part of the fire service. We expect it in every part of the fire service until we start getting to the white shirt chief level officer, where suddenly you're just kind of expected to know it, right? And that's a really dangerous thing, and it's going to put departments, individuals, communities at a level of risk that they don't necessarily need to accept.
Yeah, and I look at, you know, when it comes to the filling in the gaps and things like that, one thing that I was caught off guard on this year was, and something I had never thought about and was never really conveyed to me, and it's not anybody's fault, but you talk about protecting your organization and where your members are protecting the public through operations and all the programs that you do and training and drilling and crossing the threshold. I started getting emails in early December from offices of legislatures from the state, all these pre-filed mm-hmm. bills, and you know what I'm talking about. Hundreds of them. As a chief, you have to read them all, because this year in the state of Missouri, there's a huge push to as drastic as paying personal property taxes, capping real estate taxes, and everything in between, how health benefits are paid out, work comp reform. If you're a chief and you don't read those, and then what they do is they ask for a financial impact.
Yes.
So then if you want to just ignore them, you can, but you have an obligation to your community and to your members to identify all of those things, those little nuanced things, and how they will affect your organization and reply. And it took me probably 2 weeks just to try to figure out impacts. And not all of them were financial, but figuring out financial impact on these state filed bills. And that's where you talk about having a seat at the table and being able to figure out how do you formulate what a financial impact is of a cap on real estate taxes for people 65 and older in your community. And
absolutely.
You know, those things are critical, and does a master's degree give you that? No, but it exposes you to how public policymakers dive into that. And it does give you a little bit of background. You know, real quick, we got about 15 minutes left. You alluded to it earlier in regards to what people do, and not everybody if full disclosure, my department, not a position in our department requires a degree, even mine. And we're working on to see what's fair about that and how we go about that. But, you know, the one thing that we had talked about prior to the show tonight was it's across the board, whether it's the International Code Council committees, whether it's NFPA committees, whether it is and people like to sometimes downplay the roles that these organizations have. The International Association of Fire Chiefs, they are a huge mover in policy at the national level, and people may not understand
Absolutely.
That. And you can get on committees to help drive that. I guess the one thing that I want to kind of discuss before we close out of here is, so we want salty, experienced fire officers, chief officers, to be able to pull people out and to be competent on the fire ground if that's what their role is. Then we need more of those fire officers getting degrees to match the requirements that city managers, city, county managers, councils, boards are putting as requirements for chief officers. Because I'm here to tell you, you can stomp your feet and pound the table all you want. They're not going to change those requirements. So
right.
It's incumbent upon us to say, okay, well, if we don't want a pencil pusher who's never spent the time crawling down a hallway running our departments, then we need to quit just complaining about it and get the people that have the experience that we want to get these requirements so that we have a good balance and we have the people in the right places.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And the reality is, like, city managers don't know what we do, right? I mean, generally speaking, I think two city managers, one's out in Virginia, I think one's out in California, who went from the fire chief role to the city manager role. And let me tell you, I would very much like to work for either one of them, but that is the rare, rare exception. A city
right.
manager will look at your public safety entities like law enforcement, like the fire service, and they are looking at them as a business unit. They don't care. I shouldn't say they don't care. They don't put the same value that we do on your husband or wife pinning your badge on your chest, right? They don't look at a smoked out helmet with the same sense of pride that we probably do. To them, it is a business unit of the city. And I'll use my example in St. Louis. St. Louis is depending on the year, between $51 and $57 million operation to run the fire department. Put that into business dollars, like put that into something that makes widgets, right? A board of directors is probably not going to hire somebody with only a high school education to come in and run a $55 million organization. That doesn't mean that they can't. I want to be really clear. I'm not negating what people can bring to the table as exceptional leaders. There are plenty of examples of people who've done amazing things without degrees. I'm saying that generally speaking, boards of directors are not going to invite that person in to find out how amazing they are. This goes back to the piece of paper being your ante. It's being the buy-in to get you into the room and give you a set of tools to start navigating some of the problems that are either present or is perceived to be present by outside, by people outside of the profession, whether that's in your own city or in your community or in the nation at large. And when we talk about wanting salty people, and we talk about groups like the I Chiefs, like UL, like NFPA, there's a lot of gravitas. And you know, I think you and I or somebody recently that I was talking to, we were talking about the FDNY. If you look at the upper echelon of the FDNY, there are some hard charging, smoke eaten, was at ground zero chiefs working in the FDNY, and almost all of them have bachelor's degrees, and a majority of them have graduate degrees. Right? Now, this is not because the FDNY is a bunch of pencil pushing paper nerds. Right? I mean, the guys that I went to NPS with, the second masters for me, these are guys who, one of them's the division chief in Manhattan, you know, right now he's working this evening. Like, Frank is an exceptional fire commander. He served as a busy lieutenant, a busy captain. He was at ground zero. Like, Frank is the epitome of what you want. And Frank not only has a graduate degree, he takes time off work every year to go to UL to work on high rise procedures, to work on firefighter cancer issues, to work on flow path, doing some really scientific modeling with engineers and folks who aren't firefighters but are working on firefighter research issues. And he is able to communicate with them and give them insight into, look, this is how it's actually going to work. Should we be changing this? Like, this is tremendous insight, and the entire fire service is benefiting from the work that Frank and other people at FDNY are currently doing. I mean, I can name you 12 departments in the next 12 seconds that are using FDNY high-rise policies as their own policies, including some fire departments here in Missouri.
Right.
FDNY didn't go around the kitchen table and say, hey, what do you guys think we should do, right? They went and they tested it, and they brought engineers in, and they brought sensors in, and they brought data scientists in, and they burned and they burned and they burned and they burned out at their tower until they figured out what the data was actually telling them and not just what, you know, well, I feel like, right? And then they had some really good information to craft policy on. They went out, they took the policy out to the membership and, you know, asked for feedback. Hey, what are we missing? What works? What doesn't? But they didn't just kick it to the street and say, what do you guys want to do? And it's finding that center, right? So again, I'm going to brag on them a little bit here, but I've seen the St. Louis City Fire Chief show up at more multiple alarms than I can count. And he didn't show up and take command. He would show up just to see how it was going. He'd go talk to his chiefs. He'd see a captain he knew from when he was in the streets. He'd go talk to him. And it meant a lot for members to see him walking around on scene. I know one night when we were dealing with some Ferguson stuff, myself and two other tactical medics were, you know, in an area that wasn't right on the front lines at the moment. And out of nowhere walks the fire chief wearing a bulletproof vest and a helmet and khaki pants. And he walked up and wanted to know how we were doing. Did we have what we needed? When was our last day off? Everything going okay? Part of it is like he's a fireman to his core, right? He's third generation. He had a family member killed on the job. Like, he's a fireman to the core, but that stuff is also important as a chief. And I did this. I tried to do this at the state level. As the chief of operations, I was responsible for running the highway patrol, right? I have never been a state trooper. I don't necessarily know what they need and don't need. I can look at big trends. I can know what communities are talking about. I can understand what legislators are kind of leaning towards and things like that, but I've never been a trooper. So I'm not going to write policy that says this is how you will stop a car, right? This will be the policy for terminating pursuits. That's not something that's in my wheelhouse. And if you want to be in a leadership role, you have to start letting go of ego and saying, I recognize what I don't know. Let me pull some people that I trust in next to me to help me explain the option sets, explain where we need to go with this. Tell me why this will and won't work. And I think that's something that every fire chief can certainly, you know, if you're not pressure testing ideas with the rank and file, you know, you're at a disadvantage. If you're not incorporating their thoughts and concerns early in the process, that's a problem, and that's a leadership value failure, and that's something we should do a better job of. I know we've talked a lot about what chiefs should do. One thing that I don't think happens enough in the fire service is seeking feedback from the guys and gals sitting around the kitchen table. They're going to have a very important view. It's also going to be one view, It doesn't mean that you do exactly what they want or exactly what they, you know, hope will happen, but it means that you go and you have seeked out that that counsel. You've gone, you've explained your position, you've explained kind of what the standard is, you've given a viewpoint of where you'd like the department to end up around a certain issue or policy or culture, and then they're allowed to kind of give you some feedback into that. Now you own that, right? Part of the dichotomy of leadership is that you own the outcome, good or bad, right? We give all good credit to the team, and we own all of the negative repercussions of our decisions. You want to be saluted, you want to be in charge. That's the price of wanting to be in charge. So you ultimately own the outcome, and you have to do what's right for your membership and your community. But if you're not going out and seeking that feedback and getting that guidance, then that is a failure. And I think that's something that every department that I have been a part of and every department that I've worked with, which, you know, was hundredth at the state level. I mean, I was going to, you know, two or three fire departments a week at one point. I think that's one thing that every fire department can do a little bit better at. I think that will help organizational buy-in and some of what we're talking about around the buy-in for people who are coming with certifications or degrees or things like that.
Yeah, and I think you make a great point that, you know, we talked about the challenges of getting, you know, the attitudes and perceptions of those that have the degrees in education changed. At the same time, you can't get a chief's job and you've got this degree in education and lock yourself in an office and think you've got all the answers because of that. You make a really good point that it doesn't relieve you of the responsibility to stay in touch with, and of course, the larger the department, the more difficult that is, but it doesn't mean that you've got all the right answers. It's just simply another tool, critical tool, but you still have to stay in touch with the people on the floor.
Absolutely. The best captains that I've worked with, and I've been really fortunate over my career to have some exceptional officers, lead me both, when I was a private, having really good line officers, when I moved into a command role, having good senior chiefs, you know, above me. I not only did I hear them say, like, yes, you should go continue your education, this is good. Not only was I not dissuaded from doing that, which was important, especially as a young firefighter in my 20s, you know, again, pardon my, you know, taking shit for going to school.
Right. Right.
You know, once I was on the job, not only was I being supported by, officers above me, I also watched what they did. And, you know, I mean, we can, this is almost too simplistic, but, you know, there is, you know, what you do carries far more impact than what you say. And, you know, people will see if you're going out on the floor and you're asking people, hey, how's that new tool we're demoing actually working? Right. I can't tell you the number of times that I've watched senior chiefs, you know, bona fide battalion commanders working in busy districts. It's their fourth or fifth fire of the day. And they'll go walk up to a fire private who's a driver and say, Mike, what do you think about that smoke coming out of that eave there? Right. Or they'll go up and they'll find a good senior leadoff firefighter, a guy or a gal who's just, you know, who wants nothing more than to drag hose in the burning building and go, you know, hey, Todd, you think we got it on the second floor? Or you think we need to send some more guys up there? That is not a salty chief abdicating his responsibility to make good command decisions, but it shows that they are comfortable enough in their role to ask, you know, those who are in ranks lower than them what they think. What's their opinion? What's your experience in similar cases? And am I missing something? And I always thought that was a really cool thing. And not every chief that I've worked with has done that, but the good ones, the ones that I've respected, as good leaders to try to emulate in my own career, have always been very forthcoming with reaching out to other people they respected, regardless of their rank, asking for their feedback.
Right.
Yeah, and I think to kind of close this thing out tonight, I think, and both of us would agree to this, that you don't have to have a graduate degree to be a good chief, and you don't have to have a bachelor's degree to be a good company officer or any of those things. I think it's the idea that you need to get yourself in a position that whatever you aspire to be, you're going to be most effective. And it could be different for every department, but the idea that just because you do have a graduate degree doesn't lessen the experiences that you had. Now, I think to be fair, there are chiefs out there, and I don't know where they are, but there are chiefs out there that have their entire career only pursued to get the paper, to get a chief job somewhere. And those people are problematic. They can be very problematic for the fire service, and we're certainly not advocating for that. We're advocating, I think the overall, at least my personal opinion is this, is that if we want to change NFPA, we have to get the right people on NFPA committees. If we want to change building codes and model codes and how they're applied in our world, we have to get more people involved in code development and on the ICC committees. If we want to be more involved and see policies that are important to us at the boot level and in the fire service, we need to get and be participative in the IAFC and get on those committees and be involved in that policy creation. And I think if we want to have a seat at the table, county, city government, and boards and council chambers with, I mean, you know as well as I do, Greg, a lot of the politicians, especially in the St. Louis area, that are getting on councils, boards, mayors, are lawyers and doctors. They're highly educated
yes.
people.
Right.
Doesn't make them good politicians. But what it
right.
does do is it puts the burden on us to have to be able to relate to them what our job is. And those degrees, that formal education at whatever level it is, can be very, very beneficial. And what I don't want to see is the fire service turning a negative tone towards formal education. We need more salty officers who want to be chiefs and who want to really make a difference, meet the requirements that are being placed on us so that they can be a difference maker and be the kind of chief that they wish they had.
It's all about what you're willing to do to have a seat at the table and you know, recognizing our time is tight. Like we provide tons of opportunity, especially in the last 5 years. I mean, you know, when I was coming up as a new guy in the fire service in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, there was one conference, right? Maybe there was MU Fire and, you know,
right.
maybe one other kind of like national one. Now, you know, you can go all over the place and you can, you know, if you've never run a cutting torch, you can run a cutting torch. If you've never rappelled, you can rappel. If you know, your department doesn't have the opportunities for you to cut up cars and you want to take a 16-hour vehicle extrication class with 8-hour specialty and electric cars, you can go do all of that. And that is super cool. And again, I think anybody who's listening to this podcast is probably hip to that. All you're doing when you take those classes, those very tactical, hands-on, running cutting torch classes, is you're putting new tools in your toolbox. Not every motor vehicle accident you go to are you going to pull out the cutting torch. At least you shouldn't. That would be a very bad thing. Do not pull out
right.
the cutting torch at every accident you go to. But you have that in the bag, right? It's like a golfer's bag. Like you have that club, you have familiarity with it. You know how and when and how to apply. We as the fire service should ask the same thing of those who want to lead. We want you to be able to know how to create budgets, how to create arguments around, you know, minimum staffing levels, to create you know, policy documents that tell your mayor, look, we're not kidding around about this. We need 4 members on a truck. All of those things are super important. And we're not saying that it's better or worse firemen. We're saying that it's firemen with more tools in their bag to be able to address the problems they're faced with, which are big, serious, long-term problems if they're handled incorrectly. And the last the last thing that I'll say is that I think for so long higher education was out of reach for a lot of responders. There's a ton of universities and colleges right now that offer first responder discounts the same way that they offer military discounts. So I'm an officer in the U.S. Navy. Still, you know, I work in the reserves, and I see what colleges are giving credit for military time and which ones have military discounts on tuition and things like that. The same is true for many, many universities around first responder education. There's a first responder grant that if you spend 10 years after graduation in public service, not even in public safety, in public service, any loan that you have is forgiven, right? That's a huge thing. That's a huge thing. You know, you look at EFO, or you look at they just came up with what is it? MFO now? Is it the
National
Fire Academy has
officer.
has a company officer level program now. That's all inclusive. Like, there's nothing outside of the beer that you drink at the outhouse. That's all inclusive. They'll pay for your flight. They'll pay for your lodging. They'll pay for your classes. They'll give you the books. There is no reason not to pursue some of these things, because there's a lot of avenues that can seriously reduce the financial impact. It's just a matter of whether or not the member is willing to do the work to meet the challenge.
Exactly. Well, Greg, we probably have material to do another podcast, and we'll get together and we'll come up with another topic. Cause I think you've got a lot of great information, and I think tonight was a good lead in to future topics. I can't thank you enough for coming on tonight. And I know that you and I will stay in touch on a lot of different things, because you've done things I want to do. So
sure.
I'll be reaching
sure.
out as I have in the past. But
certainly,
if anybody wanted to get a hold of you, what would be an easy way to reach out to you?
Sure. So for those who are on Twitter, it's Greg, G-R-E-G-G, Favre, F-A-V-R-E. Or you can email me at Greg, G-R-E-G-G, at gregfavre.com.
Perfect. Because I'm sure the people who listen to this, usually we get people to contact the guest and want some information. And I know that you've got a lot of background. So
sure. We're happy to have the conversation.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And again, we're going to do this again, and we'll have a running topic on this stuff. So on behalf
Great.
Of all the instructors at Engine House Training, Fire Engineering, Bobby, Diane, Peter, all the people that make this possible, and for all of you that listen in whenever you listen in, thanks for letting us be in your ear tonight and talk about a topic that some of it you may agree with, some of it you may not, but that's the beauty of the fire service, right? So, you know, take what works for you and forget the rest, or come back to it later. So don't forget FDIC, just a couple months away. We're getting really close. I'll be there most of the week, and look forward to seeing everybody out there. And in the meantime, keep training, learning, and sharing what you know. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Thanks, Chief. Bye.
Hey, see you, Greg. Thanks so much.